Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today we come to you from San Francisco. Well, as you all know, we're not actually in San Francisco. We are on a Zoom call. No, it's not a Zoom call. It's a Squadcast call, but we call it Zoom. We call all video conferencing Zoom. We were talking earlier with our guest just about those phrases that we use that can get us in trouble. Not in trouble, but don't accurately describe. We are video conferencing on Squadcast. And today we are going to be speaking with Jennifer Stojkovic, who is the executive director of SF City, a trade association in San Francisco that takes care of the tech industry and all the issues around that. A few weeks ago, we had Cesar Fernandez on from talking from about the Miami tech scene. And we are now going to be going back and talking about the tech scene in San Francisco or Silicon Valley and hear all about that. Jennifer, welcome.
Hello, hello. How's it going, Jim?
Good. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. Very diplomatic introduction there. Join us on our virtual conference / Zoom / Meet / Team / what did we forget?
Exactly. You got to hit all the right, you know, we got to catch ourselves because, you know, we all use the word Zoom. Zoom has become that word. So Jennifer, how are things in San Francisco? It has been a crazy year. So for our listeners that may not know, the little bit that I know that the schools have not reopened in San Francisco, which has been a little bit of an issue. Most of your member companies are probably, if not all, working remote. So a lot of people have probably left San Francisco. And you're probably looking at the future. And, you know, we heard about the Miami tech scene, which, you know, the one thing that Florida and places like Austin and Miami have is they don't have an income tax, which is one significant difference. But so what has the last year been like for you?
All right. So to paint a picture to folks that are tuning in from potentially outside of the Bay Area, it is quiet in San Francisco. So San Francisco was the first city in all of the United States to really put in shelter in place requirements. And at this point, as of our time of recording, we are 50 weeks in, I believe, to having folks go home and stay at home to some degree in the city of San Francisco. So while other parts of the country have, you know, gone back and forth over open and closed, and some have schools that are currently in person versus Zoom, San Francisco has largely been closed for almost an entire year. That does include the San Francisco Unified School District. So almost 10,000 of our kids have not been in in-person learning environments for this entire time. For the tech industry in particular, the tech industry was the first to close. There's actually some folks that believe that tech's early closures in both Seattle, San Francisco, and other tech cities could have been part of what flattened our curve. The jury's still out on that. I know that there's going to be some really interesting data that comes out when we can study the pandemic a little bit later down the road. But definitely tech was one of the first in the country to close down. And most tech companies have not come anywhere close to reopening. Our offices were more than 90% occupied. If you had talked to me this time a year ago, they dropped down to less than 5% occupied, save for a little bit of facilities folks, or perhaps some hardware folks where they really need to go into the office. Essentially, nobody's been going into those towers.
And the challenges going forward for your area, you know, there's been the quality of life issues, the cost of living in the area, the homeless issue, and others. As we begin to come out of the pandemic, how do you see San Francisco dealing with that?
So housing affordability is a really big problem in not just San Francisco and the Bay Area, but the entire state of California. We have, for the last 5 years or so, created on average 8 times as many jobs as we have housing units in the Bay Area. So I'm going to repeat that for everybody listening. 8 to 1. So you can imagine how much of a squeeze it has been to try to find housing in San Francisco for the past few years. In particular, we were the most expensive place in all of the United States, more expensive than Manhattan, for the last few years. And so the average medium one bed was about $3,600 a month before the pandemic hit. And I don't know about the rest of y'all, but I can tell you when I was growing up, I thought Manhattan was the most expensive place that you could live in North America. So to think that we outpaced it that substantially many years ago is pretty shocking. But that is the case in San Francisco. And it's no secret that there's certainly a homelessness epidemic that is happening in the city as well. We have quite a few folks that are unhoused on a nightly basis, somewhere around, depends on the study. They're saying that it could be upwards of 9 or 10,000 right now in San Francisco. I don't think we've done a homeless count in the last few months, but it has always been quite high in San Francisco and has for several decades now. It continues to be an issue. These folks are just not getting the services that they need. There is not enough affordable housing stock to move many of these folks into more steady housing. And, you know, quite frankly, a lot of folks have also started to move into the Bay Area or into San Francisco during the pandemic. That's one of the things that's been cited on the news in the last few months is that many folks have moved into San Francisco because there is significantly more services for the unhoused in San Francisco than other parts of the region and even the state.
Yeah. And you're always going to have the issue of the winters in Minnesota are a lot colder than San Francisco. And, you know, the warmer climates are going to have more people that are going to be unhoused and homeless. And I know that the political dynamic in San Francisco between the mayor and the Board of Aldermen and the Board of Ed is, I don't know, what's the word I want to use? Strained?
Strained, yes. Strained is a word.
Maybe not. Maybe it might be in the ballpark. I mean, look, maybe you can, one, describe what's going on for our listeners. I mean, as you mentioned, the public schools they've been remote for a year. And I think we've read that there's a lawsuit going on in regards to that. So maybe just tell our listeners a little bit about that. And then going forward, you know, what needs to happen for you to do your job, which we'll get to after this.
So let's take a step back to understand San Francisco politics. It's really important to understand a little bit about the culture of politics, right? It is no secret that in the city of San Francisco, you have to campaign harder to win even a Board of Education seat than probably half the state houses in the United States. It is extremely civically engaged. This is a city that is not shy to put signatures to the ballot and put their own ballot measures for the vote. It is a city that is not shy to run you through the ringer for even the most basic elected positions. And that has just been the culture of San Francisco for a very, very long time. As a result of that, we also produce in the Bay Area some of the nation's leading politicians, right? Our vice president came out of the Bay Area. I worked directly on my SF City Board of Directors with the campaign manager that put her in her very first elected position in San Francisco when she ran for district attorney. There's also, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the third most powerful person in America, is out of San Francisco too. So when you win a San Francisco seat, it means that you really, really, really fought hard for it. In San Francisco, we are a predominantly Democrat city. Of course, it is one of the bluest, I think it's probably the bluest city in all of America, right? So we're talking 90 plus Democrats. And so what happens in a place that is extremely civically engaged and extremely blue? You get shades of blue. So in San Francisco, we have what is known as the moderates and the progressives. So for folks that have heard the words moderates and progressives, perhaps on a national level, it's fairly similar in San Francisco in the sense that those that are on the more moderate side tend to be more collaborative with business. They tend to be a little bit slower in terms of the way that they roll out policies and legislation. Our mayor, Mayor London Breed, is considered to be a moderate. On the other side, you have the progressives. And the progressives are much, much more aligned with what you consider a Bernie Sanders type. So we actually have a registered Democratic Socialist on the Board of Supervisors. So to give you an idea of left, when I say left, I mean literally for the first time since 1974, 2 years ago, we put a Democratic Socialist on our Board of Supervisors. So this left and right, while still being very squarely Democrat and still, for really anybody else's sake, considered to be an extremely progressive group, that infighting is very, very substantial in the city of San Francisco. You would think that they were on opposite sides of the aisle with the way that some of the political infighting happens in our city. So the makeup right now of our board is supermajority progressive. So we have 11 board of supervisors, and pretty much nine, close to 10 of them are considered to be on the progressive spectrum. On the other hand, our mayor is considered to be on the moderate spectrum. So the two do not often collaborate. And as I said, because it is a supermajority, there is actually power where the board can override the mayoral veto. So the mayor does have a veto in the city of San Francisco, but it can be overridden in the rare circumstance of a supermajority. And we are in one of those rare circumstances right now. Bringing the school board into the conversation, it is often seen that the San Francisco Board of Education is basically the feeder to becoming a politician in San Francisco, right? Everybody knows the school board's probably the first thing that you run for if you want to test out, hey, do I want to be an elected official? And that is no exception in San Francisco. So we have quite a few new folks on our Board of Education that are really testing the limits, so to speak. And they have definitely swung to the hyper-progressive end of things. There have been a number of news articles that made national or international coverage in the last few weeks about some of the things that our Board of Education is working on. One of them being they just decided to rename 44 schools in the city of San Francisco. So a third of all schools are going to be renamed because they were deemed to be problematic or offensive in name. The most recent thing that you might have heard about also is about a week ago, they voted down adding a new member to one of the parental advisory committees at the SFUSD because the candidate, a LGBT male, was considered to be not diverse enough. So this gives you an idea of how left our Board of Education has gotten. So now that you can consider the three entities that are in power in the city of San Francisco, it's almost like an episode of Portlandia. If you want my honest opinion, it is the kind of thing that you would think would be a skit, but that is truly what the political makeup is in the city currently. I'll add one little element that I'll throw in there just because why not, Jim? This is the conversation we're having. All of our state leaders, so our senators and assemblymen that are elected out of San Francisco, are moderate and align with our mayor. So it's all over the place.
Boy, that is incredible. Tell us first about your association and your members.
Absolutely. So SF City was founded in 2012, back when we were starting to recover from the 2008 recession in San Francisco. So 2008 was a rough year for all of the United States, right? The Great Recession was a really, really tough time for businesses, but it also was one of the biggest booms for the modern tech economy. So most of these IPOs that you've been seeing in the last couple of years, your Ubers, your Airbnbs, Pinterest, I know you just had Braden on recently, all those companies came out of 2008. So when you hit these types of recessions, it's also known that that is a huge, huge opportunity for shakeups and innovation in the market. So San Francisco really started to see this budding tech industry emerging post-2008 around 2010, 2011 or so. And at the time, we had double-digit unemployment rates, which seems crazy to think because before the pandemic, we had close to 3% or less, which is considered to be a fully employed city. So our mayor that went into power at the time in 2011 really saw tech as a huge way for us to get out of the budget deficits and climb out of the hole that San Francisco really was in due to the 2008 collapse and said, why don't we try growing this new industry and bringing these new tech companies that are emerging on a daily basis into our city to help revitalize our city? And through that, there was a number of tax policies that were created. A big one that many folks might have heard about is the mid-market tax break, aka the Twitter tax break. It was a tax break that was essentially designed so that we could take some areas in the city called the South of Market that were really crumbling warehouses and be able to bring new life and new energy to them. So essentially, let's convert some of these warehouses into offices for these new tech companies. And so through that creation, we then started working on Proposition E, which was reforming the entire business tax system in San Francisco. So San Francisco back in 2012 was the only city and county in all of California to still administer a payroll tax as its primary taxation method on business, which makes no sense for a burgeoning industry, right? You don't want to disincentivize job growth, which is exactly what a payroll tax does, we now know. So we move towards a gross receipts tax, which is based upon how the company does receipts every year, their profits, how they're doing. That's how they're taxed. Through those different initiatives coming together with the mayor, we created an entity that is now known as SF City. So that is my association, of which I am the executive director. And we are really the liaison between the tech industry and the city of San Francisco, the community of San Francisco. We work with the superintendent. We work with all kinds of nonprofit leaders. We work a little bit in Sacramento with many of the leaders over there to ensure that we are growing San Francisco in a way that we're promoting both innovation and job growth, as well as making sure that we are utilizing all of tech's resources to make the city a better place. So back in 2012, when we were first created, it was a very, very different time for the city. We're now in 2021. So we've been doing this just shy of 10 years. And it's been a wild time for tech, that's for sure.
Well, it seems like you had incredible success back in 2012 with the changes that you made to the tax system. And, you know, all we hear about is, you know, governments that are not working, and even in places like San Francisco. I mean, those are some incredible changes that happened back in 2012.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the problems that we have, and we say this time and time again, is that voters really have a short memory. I think a lot of folks don't realize that San Francisco, it was before the pandemic, a booming, thriving city. There was more jobs than you could possibly imagine, right? So San Francisco was the hottest job market in all of the United States. And to think that just less than 10 years before that, it was double digit unemployment, but it really was. And that's how quickly things can change. Now, of course, we're on the precipice of a very new era for San Francisco post pandemic. And again, that's something that we want folks to understand and really take seriously, that that can change very quickly. Just like it changed very quickly last time, we can end up in a very similar economy that can have a huge, huge downturn very, very quickly. So making sure that people understand just how significant the job growth was for the city, just how significant it was to bring in these folks from all over that were able to grow these companies. 47% of all founders in the Bay Area are immigrants. You know, it is a very, very exciting city. It's a very exciting place to be in the world. San Francisco was seen as the best place on earth to start your company before the pandemic. I'd like for us to continue that capital. I'd like for us to continue being the place to start a company, but I'm not too sure that we still are the best place in the world to start your new tech company.
Yeah, it's really amazing that, as you said, prior to the pandemic, it was really second to none. I mean, there was almost no question. There was maybe a little, some movement to states where there isn't an income tax, let's say, and that's maybe difficult to compete with if that's what someone, you know, if that's all they care about. So going forward, let's think about post-pandemic. What are some of the changes you think need to happen, you know, besides the kids going back to school and those things, for San Francisco to remain or become once again the place where founders want to be?
So to address your first comment, I think it's really important for folks to understand the tax structure of California and San Francisco. So while the state constitution prohibits a local income tax a la New York City, San Francisco and the state of California still have extremely high tax rates. And it looks a little different depending on whether you are a worker, a tech worker that's thinking about, hey, do I want to build my career here? Or you are a business. So while there is not a local income tax that is levied on tech workers, there are other things that are very important and top of mind when it comes to relocating to California. California has a capital gains tax. It is the only state in the United States to have a capital gains tax in addition to the federal capital gains tax. So that is very significant if you are a founder or somebody that's joining a company very early on, because what that means is that when you do have that exit of whatever it might look like, whether it's an acquisition or some other liquidity event, you do have an additional nearly 14% tax on those gains. Might not sound like a lot right now, but if this is what you've decided to make your life's work, that can really add up to a lot.
So the capital gain tax is at the same highest level as the income tax, right? 13.9?
Yeah, so it's 13 something. So the capital gains tax is additional to your federal capital gains tax that you will pay.
Wow.
So there's another thing that, you know, while there is not a city tax, there are other things that might affect your decision to start your company or to grow as an early startup employee in San Francisco. Otherwise, I do think that there is some pros and cons to California versus some of the other places that you mentioned, right? Washington has no state income tax. Florida has no state income tax. Texas has no state income tax. Those are three of the top places where they're hoping to relocate tech workers, right? But at the same time, there's also a lot less state infrastructure. And I think right now is a very prime example of that, of what's going on in Austin as we speak. Texas is the number one magnet for Californians to move. Last year, the number one state for Californians to head to was Texas and primarily Austin. And now, as we speak right now, what are they, 72 hours into an outage at this point in their snow and ice storm? So I think a lot of people are considering, is a state income tax that works successfully and makes me feel like I actually am getting the dollars out of it that I put in, is that worthwhile? And I think it will be interesting to see in these coming weeks if this really gives people a little bit of food for thought as to whether they do want to move to some of these other states and these ramifications. The other thing that we also missed entirely this year was a bad hurricane season. So folks trying to move to Miami and start a tech company there might have a very different opinion come this time next year.
And you may find places like Austin may find, as you were just indicating, that they run into some growing pains, mm-hmm. which San Francisco and Silicon Valley has faced over the last 20 years, but has kind of dealt with it.
Yeah. We do have wildfires, though. That's going to be one of the significant. Yeah. I do think that the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic with everybody locked inside and their sky went orange will have long-lasting psychological effects on a lot of the folks in the area. And that has been cited as one of the turning points for many people that I've spoken to that have decided to leave San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do think that the climate issue is something we haven't really talked about very much, but it is something that is not going away. The wildfire season last year was the worst wildfire season on record. The wildfire season the year before that was the worst wildfire season on record, right? Four of the five worst state fires ever were last year. So as we think about how tech is going to begin to decentralize from the Bay Area, we should think very thoughtfully about where is that decentralization going to occur? Because if they're moving towards a more hub and spoke based model, which we now know is that is the way that most tech companies are going, and I can speak more about that in a moment, are we moving to areas that are also going to be prone to those same kinds of emergencies? And Miami and Texas very well could be.
So tell us about that model. Is the idea that you have, let's say, executives and some of the more tech workers in San Francisco, and then you can have other workers scattered throughout the country depending on what they're doing?
Yeah. So I'll talk through the three types of models. So there is an HQ model, which is the way that most tech companies currently exist. There's a hub and spoke model, which is based around more hubs. And then there is a decentralized model, which is really not having any consortium of workers located in any specific area. So the headquarters model is the way that we have traditionally done business for the last 100 years, both in tech and beyond. And so what that means is that you'll have a large physical footprint somewhere. The majority of your executives and your leaders and your employees will be located there. If you have other presences around the country, they're likely closer to like a satellite type office. They're unlikely to have executives and folks in leadership to be in those other offices because it's really what I call the mothership model. And so we have many of those in San Francisco, and we have many of those dotting all up and down the Silicon Valley. The next more interesting, not quite decentralized and not HQ model is hub and spoke. So the hub and spoke model is creating full hubs for your company where there are executives and leaders located in each of these different hubs. So rather than everybody being located in one big building, you're actually deciding to diversify where your talent is around the country or the world. And so this is something that Dropbox is famously moving towards. So Dropbox wants to have different Dropbox studios located all across the country and beyond, where there will actually be leaders and executives creating a full, robust experience that you would expect to get in the California office, except for you might be getting it in Nashville, or you might be getting it in Raleigh, or you might be getting it in Denver. So rather than being beholden to one key city where all of your employees need to move in, you have these areas all around where they're all self-sufficient offices. One of the really compelling arguments towards a hub and spoke model is the equity argument. So if you're senior in your career, this is not that big of a deal because you've already elevated yourself and created relationships with executives that are going to continue to be fruitful for the rest of your career at both the company and beyond. But for younger employees, more junior employees, everyone knows that leadership time, executive face time is extremely, extremely important to be able to elevate your career and move up in the company. And so we're seeing a lot of companies that are moving to these hub and spoke models decide that this is the most equitable way so that employees all over will still get that same opportunity to grow their career. This is also a really good way to make sure that you have a more diversified workforce. If you've got a growing community in Atlanta, Georgia, it's going to look very different than your hub that's in Seattle, Washington. And that's a good thing. That creates more empathy for your users who are going to buy your product or your services. It also allows for you to decentralize where a lot of the amazing tech jobs and opportunities are. So that's what hub and spoke really brings to the table. The last one is the decentralized model, and it means not having any real tech presence anywhere and not really basing yourself around an office, but more so existing in a remote environment.
Well, I think we can agree that the hub and spoke model has the best name.
Yeah. It also looks the coolest, like on a diagram.
Yeah. You get that, you instantly get that picture in your mind. You're like, yeah, I'll go with that.
Yeah. And 76% of companies are going with that or decentralized. So 3/4 of, so we did a recent study of tech founders as well as Initialized Capital. We actually both did ours in the same week, and 3/4 of all tech founders in the Bay Area said that they are moving to a decentralized or hub and spoke model.
And so tell us a little bit about your members. How many members do you have and how often do you have to communicate with them?
So our members, we represent all of the largest tech employers in San Francisco. So everyone from Salesforce to Google to Microsoft to Airbnb, all the way down to representing the smaller startup ecosystem, which is, of course, hundreds of startups all across San Francisco. The way that we have decided to communicate, of course, is through virtual conferencing with no specific brand name attached. So we have done exactly what you and I are doing right now, Jim. We have just done, you know, virtual meetings to communicate with them. We do virtual lobbying now as well. That's a fun.
It is. It's so awful.
Fun term. Yeah, it's so weird. It's very, very hard to have a relationship with folks through a screen. But we do continue to meet with elected officials on a regular basis. And we have since, you know, of course, when March 5th happened and we all closed our offices, we just all shifted to Zoom and or whatever company it might be. So yeah, so we interface like this.
How many employees do you have at the association?
So there are 3 FTE and we have 5 contractors. Okay. Small but mighty team.
Someone asked me, they said, well, why is remote lobbying so tough? And I said, well, if they're doing something that they know you're not, you know, particularly in favor of, it's so easy for them to hide. You know, if they think that, you know, a business or an entity or something, and it's, you know, it's very hard to catch people remotely and they don't want to be caught.
It's also intimidating too. Some of the, I'm just thinking back to, especially in the summer, some of the legislation that we worked on where there's just like 10 of our little screens and we're all just staring at the elected official as they're speaking. I can't imagine that's a positive experience for them. It must be worse when you do these like town halls. The school board meeting that I referenced, the infamous one from last week where they decided not to bring that candidate on, had over 500 parents on the Zoom call.
500.
500. Yeah.
Oh my God.
500 people.
Yeah. And it's impossible to have small talk. And then when you get into the actual meeting itself, no matter how smooth it is, it's disjointed. Like I'm sure that hearing, you know, as people are debating an issue, we've seen it when, even when they're discussing something they agree on or a consent calendar, it can drag on because it's just, it's very difficult remote. I have noticed that the public hearings where people can come on and testify for 3 minutes, there's a lot of advantages to that because people don't have to come to the Capitol. They don't have to spend an entire day and the legislators get to hear and see them and they can also go back and look at the recording. So you could argue in some ways the public hearing, remote video conferencing, not to use the word that we all use, is in some ways advantageous.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We brought on the city's chief information officer a few months into the pandemic to talk about, you know, bridging the digital divide and the implications it's had on the city's services. And one of the things that she remarked even early on was that the public engagement for otherwise mundane, you know, committee hearings and things like that, where maybe three or four folks could turn out, but quite honestly, the rest of the folks were probably working because they're always at like 10 a.m. or something like that, where other folks, there's no way that they'll be able to attend. They had a lot more people turning out, and there continues to be much higher civic engagement on these types of public hearings. So I do think that that is a great opportunity for us to widen civic engagement going forward. Of course, it's going to go back to being in person. We all know the government is bureaucratic and old school, so they will go back to being in person. But there is a really compelling argument for equity and accessibility to make online options as well. To give a personal example, my father is blind. And so as a visually impaired person, he has a really hard time getting a ride all the way over to city council to be able to talk to them about accessibility. And instead, he's just been joining Zoom meetings for the last 6 months where he just has to hit a button that says live, and he doesn't even turn his camera on because he always says to me, well, if I can't see them, they shouldn't get to see me.
No, you're right. A hybrid model going forward would probably work better.
Yeah.
So how long have you been executive director?
Half a decade. It's been 5 years. 5 years of watching the tech industry evolve. I mean, we've fought cafeteria bans. We've had Scootergate. We've just, it seems crazy that it's only been five. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was real. The emerging technology fights have been an interesting one. But I am happy to say that as of this moment we are speaking, Cruise does have self-driving cars with no driver in them moving around the city at this moment.
We talked about that on a podcast. We also talked with someone from Nuro, who also, and I said to, when I was speaking with Nuro, I said, well, can I ask a question? Why did you choose San Francisco, which seems like the most difficult place in the world? And he said, which kind of makes sense. Well, if we could do it there, we could do it anywhere. And I was like, exactly. Oh, okay. It makes sense.
It's the same with political, right? If you can win an election in San Francisco, you might just end up vice president.
Or Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. And so going forward, putting aside the capital gains tax and other tax issues, and I know after I say this, you're going to be like, all right, well, what else is there? But getting down into more of the smaller issues, if we put aside the capital gains tax and other tax issues, the homeless issue, which is a major, major issue, the lack of housing in the area, and the cost of housing, what are some of the smaller issues day-to-day that would help your members stay or be attracted to the San Francisco area?
So the reason that you come to San Francisco, of course, there's the views, yes, but you come because it attracts world-class talent. So at the end of the day, what our companies want is they want an environment which is collaborative so that they're not, you know, getting banned, so that they're not getting regulated in a way that they can't operate so that they can continue to pay their tax bills. But then more than that, they really just want to ensure that there's good quality of life so they can continue attracting talent. So all these types of issues, you know, talking about housing affordability, talking about, you know, issues with the unhoused, talking about transportation. Transportation is a huge, huge issue in the Bay Area. It's one that you don't hear very much about these days because we have 500 issues above it. But we have more than 30 different transportation bodies in the Bay Area, and none of them operate under one specific governing body, right? So it's very, very disjointed. It's very, very difficult to go from, say, San Francisco to Oakland. You use various different transportation methods, and all the different public transit options are not properly integrated. They've been trying to integrate all of our transportation for years now, and they've done it to varying degrees, but it just, quite frankly, does not do a good job talking to one another. So that was an area that if you had asked me a year ago, what are you guys going to work on this year? That was a big thing for tech companies. That was huge. And so was housing production. You're now seeing all kinds of different housing projects popping up all around the Bay Area where Google and Facebook are putting millions and millions of dollars down to create housing projects because they're just not getting developed fast enough, right? So to give you an idea, San Francisco is 70% single family zoning. So in 70% of the entire city, it is illegal to build an apartment. 70, not 17, 70.
That's impossible.
In the state of exactly. In the state of California, it's upwards of 80% of the entire state is zoned single family zoning.
So if you're a New York worker coming out of college, you got to live an hour outside of San Francisco to find somewhere to live that you can afford.
You're actually being a little bit kind there. We have super commuters that have started to emerge in the Bay Area, and they're typically either obviously junior level employees, or we have a lot of teachers, a lot of like middle class, really important jobs, paramedics, first responders, all of those folks, police. They have increasingly been priced out of the city because if you don't fall into affordable housing and you can't afford market rate housing, what happens to you in the middle? And what happens is you get pushed out farther and farther and farther. And it was not unheard of to hear folks that would get up at 3 a.m. to head into the city to start their job at, say, 7 a.m. So the super commuting is a very real issue. And that largely has to do with zoning as well. So we actually have been working. This was something we were going to be working really hard on. Of course, we continue to support is changing the zoning laws in the state of California. So Senator Scott Wiener, who makes national headlines quite frequently, so many folks, I'm sure, have read him in the New York Times. He's been trying for 3 years now to change the zoning around transit hubs so that it can automatically be upzoned to build apartments. So I don't know about you, Jim, but where I grew up, I'm from Toronto. It is the default that there are apartment buildings that surround where the public transit stops are. I thought every city was built like that. I thought that that was just a given to make sure that we are getting folks to and from the places that they need to go. But that is not the case in California, and that is not the case in San Francisco. So we've been trying for several years now to change that zoning to help create more housing that is more central to where people work. And it keeps getting knocked down over and over. It keeps getting knocked down. But we, of course, are adamant that we want to see this change happen. We support the senator on his work. But like I said, zoning and public transit don't sound sexy. They don't sound interesting, but they're really crucial to quality of life.
Very crucial. And when it's getting knocked down and stopped, who is typically, what groups are on the other side of that?
All right. You want to get into the plight of the California liberal? Because this one's getting hot. So California is known for being a beacon of progressive politics. And it is in many, many ways. Of course, it's where same-sex marriage began and many of the most incredible ways that we've moved forward as a culture federally started in San Francisco and in California. But one area in California where folks continue to be extremely, extremely conservative is housing. And so we have what is known as this really strange, unholy alliance of folks. So in San Francisco, many, many progressives are known for being anti-housing. And they're known for being anti-housing because they often will use the argument that we don't want to approve this building because it's not good enough. So while they don't have another building that they can put in its place, they'll often say, well, we don't think that this is meeting enough of the, you know, affordable housing percentage that we'd like it to meet. So in the city of San Francisco, you already have to have at least 20% affordable housing to build a project. That is the law. But they'll often say, no, we'd rather have it 30, 40, 50%. And oftentimes it gets to the point where it is no longer even fiscally responsible to build the project. But that's the kinds of ways that they are able to fight this and to prevent these buildings from being built, because they see it as preserving the character of their neighborhood. On the other hand, so that's our progressive folks. On the other hand, you have folks that have owned houses or are on the more affluent side of things, where they don't want to see more apartments go up in their neighborhood because they like their home. They like their view of the bridge. This is a really big problem in Southern California as well. If we pass this transit hub bill that I referred to, SB 50, if we pass it down in Southern California, that's going to affect folks in Beverly Hills. It's going to affect folks in the Hollywood Hills. And these folks don't want to see their neighborhood change either. And so you have what is known as the most progressive grassroots folks in the state, and the people that are probably the closest thing that you would have to right-wing folks in the state coming together to both agree, no, we don't want more housing. It's a very strange, unholy marriage, but it is what is happening in the state of California.
Jennifer, I feel like I'm getting a full-blown education here on California politics. This is great. How often do you have to go up to Sacramento pre-pandemic, or how much are you interacting with officials up in Sacramento?
So we actually, I just did a clubhouse a week and a half ago with our senators and assembly members. So we work with them on a frequent basis. We're really fortunate that they all have offices in San Francisco. So we bring them in to meet with all of our members, you know, every month. We usually bring in at least two legislators a month to meet with our members. So they usually come to us, thankfully, because nobody wants to go up to Sacramento. We're very fortunate that many of them are able to come and eat at Google and places like that. I don't know what it's going to look like post-pandemic, because most of these companies have closed down their cafeterias, but that was one of our selling points was, we'll come host you at Airbnb. We'll come host you at Dropbox.
After you fought to keep the cafeterias open, then now there's not even anybody there.
Yeah, 40 plus private cafeterias is 44, I think, was the last count in San Francisco, a number of which had unionized employees, might I add. Really, really good jobs.
And so what did you do prior to this to get such great training to become executive director here?
So I've had a very atypical journey towards becoming a lobbyist.
Jennifer, can I interrupt you for a second? After doing 2.5 years of interviews on this show, I don't think there is a typical path. Actually, there may be a little bit typical, go to the Hill, go inside, whatever. But there are so many atypical paths. But let's hear yours.
Yeah, absolutely. So I spent my entire childhood and university career thinking that I would grow up to be a lawyer. That's what I thought. I said, you know, I really like problem solving. I like debating people. I like convincing people that I'm correct. So I'm going to become a lawyer. And things changed for me. So when I was finishing up my business law degree in my undergrad, I, like many people on this show, followed somebody. So I followed my now husband down to the United States. And so when I relocated to the United States from Canada, I was just finishing up my degree and I had the opportunity to either, all right, should I go get a job and start building a career, or should I continue on to law school? So I decided to go work at the United Way. I was really interested in the idea of community relations. And so I spent 3 years at the United Way doing community relations, learning everything it took to manage millions of dollars of grants, learning how to work with the government, learning how to work with dozens of different nonprofits and community leaders, superintendents, you name it. And when we had the opportunity to move to San Francisco, I brought that backbone with me in addition to having a business law background and thought, is there a way that I can do business law, work with companies, and also work with the community? Turns out there is a way. It's called a trade association. And it was just a perfect fit. Honestly, I had never done lobbying in my life. I didn't know what lobbying was at the time. I didn't even know what a trade association really did. I'd heard of the chamber, but when I got this job, it was a completely new, oh my gosh, I got to learn everything on the ground. It was one of those interviews where you just kind of nod your head and say, yeah, I've definitely done that before. I can totally do this. You should trust me. I am the right person for this job. Luckily, I turned out to be the right person, but I had to make myself the right person.
Well, I think they made the right choice. I could go on and on. I don't want to keep you all day. Your email is Vegan Women's Summit or Women's Summit. Tell us about that and tell us, I know you compete in athletic events. Tell us a little about your athletic endeavors.
All right. So aside from SF City and all things tech and politics, which seems to be 24 hours of my life, I actually have a few extra hours of my time. And so I work on a organization called Vegan Women's Summit, and we do media and events, specifically connecting global founders from all around the world that are working in the future of food, fashion, beauty, and technology. The reason that we have created this community and platform of 20,000 plus women founders, CEOs, and investors is because women continue to be underinvested in both the tech industry and the emerging food tech industry. So less than 3% of all capital goes towards women founders. Less than 1% of all investments worldwide go towards women founders of color. Just shocking. And so we're working to course correct that and get more VC investment going to all these amazing women that are building a kinder, more sustainable world. It's a really, really exciting time right now. More than $1.5 billion went into the plant-based space in 2020 alone. Obviously, things like a worldwide pandemic caused by the food system will certainly turn a lot of investment ears towards the work that you do. So we're working to ensure that lots of that funding and lots of that attention is going towards empowering women, specifically women of color. So that is my other mission in life, of course, and luckily a lot of what I've been able to gain from the tech industry, from these insights of how to build an industry, is very applicable to building this new burgeoning food tech industry. And when I have even more time, I try to compete and do a number of different things in the plant-based fitness space. My most recent endeavor is becoming a rescue diver, so I'm spending a lot of my time doing rescue diving. And if you ever are sunk at the bottom of the ocean and you need somebody to save your life and bring you up to the top and resuscitate you, I am your girl.
Wow. How long have you been training for to become a rescue diver?
So I've been diving for 5 years. I think I'm probably might be sub 200 dives right now. I've actually dove all around the world. Been really fortunate. So I've dove everywhere from the Persian Gulf in Oman to the Great Barrier Reef, Thailand, Indonesia. My most recent certification was here in Mexico, and just off of at the bottom of North America, there is Cozumel, which is some world-class diving. And so I've been able to, yeah, just basically get a lot of experience in, and you spend about a week doing the actual certification.
And how did you get into diving originally?
So I was at a sinkhole. And so I was in Florida. This was back when I lived in Florida. And I was at a sinkhole one day, and my friend was visiting from Canada. And we learned that, oh, you can go snorkeling in the sinkhole. So we went over to go snorkeling. And while we were going to go down into the cavern to go check out the water, we saw some folks in a pool nearby. And they had scuba gear on, and they were practicing their open water certification. And I thought to myself, wow, I mean, I can probably see a lot more of this hole if I just go underwater. I'm probably not going to see that much if I'm on the surface. How hard could it possibly be? So my husband and I walk over and we ask the instructor, hey, how do you become a diver? Is it really that hard? Does it take weeks? Does it take months? Turns out for $250, it takes 2 days. So we did a crash course in diving the next weekend and immediately became divers. And we're in that hole diving underwater 50 feet within 1 week time.
And you seem, I mean, obviously the listeners can't see you. I can see you. You seem like you love it. Is it great?
All right. Here's the thing. More than 70% of the world is underwater. So if you truly want to be able to explore, you have to learn how to go underwater. For myself, I am a huge animal lover. Going underwater is like an ocean safari, right? If anybody's ever been to Africa or been able to experience what it's like seeing some of nature's most incredible animals, incredible creatures in their natural habitat, you can do that, except for you can go underwater and see instead sharks and whales and rays and turtles and dolphins. And I've dove in Iceland. I dove in and was able to touch two continents at the same time. You can actually dive in a fissure between two tectonic plates and touch both Eurasia and North America at the same time. So if you truly want to experience what the world has to offer, you have to go underwater.
And your husband is also vegan?
Of course.
And do you all compete in, I think you mentioned that you, in the past, pre-pandemic, you competed in various events and you will again in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So the last thing he did was for his birthday, he did a marathon. But we decided to hang up our running shoes and switch to the water for now. Because really what happens when you're doing these types of fitness goals, you really just like all of your time and energy goes towards one specific type of event, right? So if you're doing a triathlon, you have to spend all of your time on that one specific type of activity, or three in that case. And so you can't really do yoga or diving or, you know, other things that you might enjoy. It'll preclude you from it because you have to be in rest mode. So that's why right now we're deciding, all right, we can do a bit of weightlifting, we can do a little bit of running, but let's make diving our number one goal. And then of course, when things open back up, I think we'll probably do a triathlon would be the next one. But you need a pool to practice in, of course. So a little hard when everything's closed.
Well, Jennifer, this has been great. It has been so wonderful to talk to you. And for our listeners, we'll have all of Jennifer's information in the show notes. But just so you know, her email is jennifer@veganwomensummit.com. That's her personal email. You can obviously, we'll have her work contact info in the notes. Jennifer, this has been so great. Great to hear about your career and the work that you do in San Francisco. And we really appreciate having you on.
Thanks so much for having me. Look forward to having this conversation in person next time, hopefully.
Yes, I think we were in San Francisco a couple of years ago. But and for our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on all of Jennifer's members, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We're on social media. And if you're bored on Mondays, you can sign up for our Monday email. It comes out with the show. It has little tidbits and things in it. And you can do that at thepoliticallife.com. And the reason we do that is so we can get your email and then we try to spam you and sell you things. No, actually, that's not what we do. We just send you an email on Monday. And it's pretty...
Well, you should start newsletters, man. I don't know if you saw The Hustle just got bought for $27 million by HubSpot. Newsletters make money. Get
they
on it,
do Jim. Make money. We need to get on it, Jennifer. So do you have a newsletter?
I do have a newsletter. So if you subscribe at veganwomensummit.com, you can get Women Founder Wednesday every Wednesday and hear about women founders across six continents working in the future of food, fashion, beauty, and technology. And if you're really interested in tech and politics, you can subscribe to our SF City newsletter at sfcity.org. We won't spam you. You'll get an update every other Thursday. So we do twice a month and you can learn about all things San Francisco tech and politics.
Well, and not only that, and I am going to sign up for that, and I would encourage our listeners to do the same. The food tech space is going to be huge. And as you just said, when you said that less than 3% of the funding goes to women founders, that is astonishing. But tell our listeners about your thoughts on the food tech space.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have ever heard of an Impossible Burger or a Beyond Burger, that is just the tip of the iceberg of what is to come in the next 2 to 5 years. So the plant-based space is going to be worth over $75 billion by 2027. It is growing at a cumulative annual growth rate of almost 10% a year. That's in addition to some of the other really exciting categories that are coming out. The world's first lab-grown chicken. So that is chicken that was grown without a chicken ever being alive, started production and started being served in Singapore in December 2020. So if you go to Singapore right now, you can go to a restaurant and have a cut of chicken that was made without a chicken ever being alive. So the future is now. All the things that you saw on Star Trek are happening now. In the next 2 to 5 years, you're going to start seeing them on your shelves. It is such an exciting time to get into the future of food technology. So the whole separate conversation, I can come on, Jim, and tell you everything, all things food.
All right, we are going to have Jennifer back. But yeah, what you were just saying, I had not heard that chicken story. I had heard that they were working on things like that. That is going to change when they can grow meat in a lab. I mean, talk about the change. It's just incredible. And the impact on the climate and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. So also in November, another thing to note for folks is that the Prime Minister of Israel tried a cell-based meat steak. So this is here. This is not theoretical technology. We're not talking about the future. We're not talking about 50 years from now. We're talking about technology that exists currently today. The only thing that's stopping it right now is scaling the production to make it cheaper, which is happening by the day, and passing regulatory hurdles. So this time next year, expect to have at least 2 or 3 more cell-based products on the market. The next one to come is cell-based seafood. I spoke with a CEO in Singapore last week. She said, give me 13 months and I'm going to be selling it in Singapore. She's already down to $72 a pound of shrimp. And this is down from thousands and thousands a year ago.
Incredible. Incredible.
It's the future. The future is now.
It is. All right, Jennifer, with that, I'm going to let you go. And to everyone else out there, stay safe, stay healthy, have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.